Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Imagine you watching a game where there are zero passes thrown, only runs and punts. That'd be kind of a boring game, wouldn't it? Well, according to author Timothy Brown, in his History of Football, we have a game very similar to that before 1906 when the forward pass came about. He'll tell us about this history and more coming up in a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of Pigskin Dispatch. Welcome once again to the Pigpen. We have an exciting topic to talk about today. We are going to go back to the roots of football. And, one of the most compelling elements of the game, the passing game. And we're going to go back and look at where it came from and what it's all about and how it derived to what it is today. And we've got an expert here who wrote a very good book called How Football Became Football, the First 150 Years of the Game's Evolution. And his name is Timothy P. Brown, and we'll bring him in right now. Timothy Brown, welcome to the Pigpen.
Hey, Darren, thank you. Appreciate you having me on. Looking forward to it.
Like we were talking before we hit record here, I read your book. It is extremely fascinating, and I love how you grab all the different elements of the football history. You're not just looking at it from the mirror image of a rules maker or of a player. You're going even in the officiating side, how officiating evolved with the game, which really caught my interest. I don't know if I've ever seen anybody do that before, but you caught the interest of all the elements of football. Well done job on that.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And I guess, just to me, and a lot of the book is about college football because a lot of the history is about college football. But for me, it goes beyond the game. There's the elements of the fans and the money and, just kind of and where it fits in society, how it reflects societal change. I think for me, those are some of the most interesting aspects of football, but it's not just a game on the field. It goes beyond that. But of course, the core of it is the game on the field.
Now, where did you get the interest to get to the point of writing books on football?
I grew up in an athletic family. I played college football. I had I coached a couple of years as a graduate assistant or as an assistant while I was going to grad school. And so I've just always had that, kind of football element. And for me, it ended up that I was, I was working in business and collecting Rose Bowl memorabilia. So that's kind of my main collecting hobby. And I had come across a story that just kind of fascinated me, which is what led to the first book, which covers the military Rose Bowl teams of World War I and World War II, or I'm sorry, of World War I, not World War II. But 1918 and 1919 Rose Bowls. And then, in doing the research for that book, I had to really understand football back then rather than the present day. So that required me to do a bunch of research. And eventually I realized that the research itself and understanding football back then was a lot of fun. And so I just kind of expanded that. And so the second book that you mentioned, How Football Became Football, reflects really the first 150 years of the game. Just how it evolved in multiple dimensions.
The other element that I thought you did a really good job on is sort of breaking football into three different segments, time segments of those 150 years. Maybe you could just share with the listeners a little bit how you broke those up and what differentiates the three.
So the reason I broke it into three eras was just that, I just felt like I couldn't just go chronological order and just, it would just be this recitation of facts. It would be kind of boring. So I wanted to kind of have some themes around what was happening in football during different time periods. And so the first era, which I just called it the early era, was from the game's beginning. So more or less 1869 with Rutgers and Princeton, and then going until 1905, which is when there were, you know, a series of rule changes due to the dangers of the game, et cetera. And so that's the first period. The second one starts at 1906 and goes until 1959. Somebody could argue with me whether it should be 1955 or 65, but you know, I have my reasons for choosing 1960, but it's at that point where from 60 on, you know, we have dramatically increased influence of television and therefore money in the game. We have dramatically increased influence of African-American players. And then there's a couple of other changes, particularly permanent use of two platoon football at the college level. And so those three things just had tremendous impact on the game as we know today. And so, you know, I chose 1960 again. You could argue a slightly different time period, but that's what I worked with.
I thought you were spot on. I would totally agree with you. 1960 being a big breaking point. And of course, 1906, which is sort of what's going to lead us into our discussion today. I guess, though, before we get to 1906, we're going to have to try to figure out what football was the first 30 some years before 1906 that brought us to that point. So maybe if you could describe us, what was football like in the early 1900s?
Yeah. So I just want to step back a little bit further first to just say,
sure. You know,
people say all the time, football evolved from rugby. And yes, that's true. But I just want to emphasize football was rugby. So the early days of what we now think of as gridiron North American football, US and Canada, it was rugby. And, you know, when they started the game, they made some minor tweaks, but it was rugby. So the game remained very much rugby-esque until, say, 1890. And they made some rule changes including allowing tackling below the waist and things like that, that made it harder to do the outside wide open running of rugby. And so the game started steering towards this, what ultimately became mass and momentum football. So mass meaning, you know, it was basically like playing goal line football, you know, a goal line offense against goal line defense, all 110 yards of the field at the time. And so the mass refers to the idea of multiple blockers leading the runner through the hole and or grabbing him by the handles that he had sewn on his pants to pull him through the hole. And the momentum referring to, you know, back then they didn't have rules on how many players had to be on the line of scrimmage. So teams would, they had guards back or tackles back formations and different things. And there was no limit on the number of men who could be moving forward at the snap, you know, similar to what Canada has in their football. So, you know, they'd have these guys running all at the same time and collapsing into a particular hole and just basically slamming into it to basically overrun one or two players on the defense. And so it was a very dangerous game. And as a result, there were lots of injuries and ultimately deaths, you know, resulting from the nature of the play at the time.
Okay, so that sort of takes us to when we always hear about, you know, President Theodore Roosevelt becoming involved because of the high death count and injury count. And, you know, many schools were, you know, canceling their football programs. And I guess that sort of takes us up to the 1905 season. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the whole thing with Roosevelt is a little bit overblown, but you know, it was more, I think it was a high profile act on his part. I mean, there's nothing he could do to ban football, right?
You know, right.
But, you know, he was a football supporter. He was a fan. You know, he was at the 1905 Army-Navy game at the end of the season. His son played for Harvard, at least the freshman team at the time. And he was a big believer in, you know, kind of that whole masculinity thing that was behind, you know, football at the time. So he was a fan. So he wanted to make sure the game continued. And at the end of the day, Harvard, Yale, and Princeton controlled the game. They were still, even in 1904, 1905, they were the three schools, Penn maybe a little bit, but they were the schools that controlled the game, and they had core responsibility for the rulemaking bodies. It wasn't until 1904 that a non-Easterner, Amos Alonzo Stagg, who had played at Yale but was coaching at Chicago, he was the first non-Easterner on the rules committee. So, you know, anything that was wrong with football, it was due to the guys out east.
Okay.
And the good things about football were due to the guys out east too.
Right. So there was sort of a reluctance on their part to want to change the game, that I take it. They liked having that game. I guess the flying wedge was gone by that point, but just like you said, the massive collision goal line play every play, they sort of liked that, and they didn't want to see that changed, I take it.
Yeah. So, you know, one of their big arguments, and with a fair amount of truth to it, but you know, the whole death count thing came from a series of newspapers. You know, they would track what was happening around the country. And so the death count really was not, it wasn't a bunch of college players from, you know, top-notch college teams. They counted anything from, you know, a lot of the deaths were just kids playing sandlot football or backyard football. A lot of them, you know, they had no coaching. They were just playing. They didn't know how to tackle. The death count also included kids who maybe got cut or spiked on the field and got an infection. Well, they couldn't treat infections like we can today. And so some of those guys died from an infection they sustained on the football field. So on the one hand, the death numbers are exaggerated, but that doesn't get take away from the fact that it was a dangerous game. And here and there, there were some college athletes who were killed playing the game. And some of what brought it to a head at the end of the 1905 season was an NYU player, New York University player, who was killed, and their college president, you know, basically took up the banner and really pushed for change and started organizing change in what ultimately became, he organized the group that ultimately became the NCAA.
So I take it, though, even though Roosevelt's threat was a little bit idle, it was sort of a pivotal point in getting these groups to talk about the revisions and reform that was needed in football. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. I think that's true. I mean, it put pressure on the big schools to make change. And then what ended up happening was like with NYU and some others, they just basically got to a point where they just said, you know, we're not paying attention to you anymore. You're not going to make the rules anymore. We're going to make the rules. And eventually those two groups kind of agreed to get together, you know, kind of compromise on some of the rule changes that ended up taking place.
So if I'm looking at this correctly, we have, you know, the Yale camp, Harvard and Penn and would you say Columbia was the other one?
Princeton.
So we have the Walter Camps of the world on that side. And then on the other side, who's on the other side that wants to have the reform?
Yeah, it was mostly schools that would now be considered D3 schools or D2. You know, they're just, but it was a mishmash. You know, by and large, the folks at Army and Navy kind of supported the old world too. You know, the old school game. So it's more or less that the teams that were at the top of the heap at the time really had no reason to change. And the truth is that those schools where they had effective coaching, the guys were conditioned before practice, they had the best of the equipment and training. They really had, you know, a limited number of serious injuries and deaths. So they kind of felt like, look, the problem isn't us. The problem is everybody else who doesn't know what they're doing. You know, I think that was really kind of the crux of the argument. But at the end of the day, even those folks realized that they needed to make some changes. And so it was really going to be a matter of how do we compromise? How do we find ways to allow change without overturning the game that they had grown to love? You know, back then, people, you know, you go back and read newspaper articles from 1903, 1904, and they'll just go on and on about the virtues of some great punter. Now, we now think of a punter as like the guy of last resort. Nobody wants to punt, right?
Right.
People punted on first down, third, second down all the time. And it was just such an integral part of the game that if you were a good punter, you were a star. You know, Now typically you were also the fullback or halfback on the team, but punting was a very highly regarded activity.
That explains why I know we talked about a game where they had, I think, no second downs. They punted on first down every play because of the inclement weather. I forget what it was. We talked about that on one of the podcasts recently. Okay, so we're at this meeting now. I take it after the end of the 1905 season before 1906 starts. And we have these two groups getting together. So I'm taking it that the forward pass was one of the suggestions that were brought to the table to help open up the game, to help make it a little bit safer. Is that true?
Yeah. So, you know, there were a lot of different suggestions, right? So, and really kind of coming, despite the fact that the Easterners controlled things, there was input coming in from across the country. You know, I mean, anything ranged from the forward pass, which ultimately got implemented in 1906, though heavily restricted. 1906, they also approved the onside kick from scrimmage. So it was essentially a punt in which the offensive team, any member of the offensive team could recover the punt and advance it. So just like, you know, we think about it, an onside kick today, the kicking team can recover it. Well, they had opened up the game by allowing the kicking team to recover punts as well. And there had been a forerunner to that that was a little bit more restrictive, but that kind of what they call the quarterback kick that carried on until 1922. So it remained a part of the game for a while.
Well, there's some good things that why people would want to be punting on first down then, huh? To try to advance the ball in a long way, because you don't have the pass at that point in time. So maybe that's a good way to get a good chunk of yardage if you're in a stalemate. So interesting.
Yeah, and if you think about it, like the punting was a natural part of the rugby-ish game, right? So every team had skilled punters. And so what you wanted in this case was a punter who could kind of kick it off to the side and one of your ends or somebody else could run down and get it. Whereas the forward pass was either something that didn't really change the game much or entirely brand new, depending on how you define the forward pass, which I think is another big misconception in terms of people's understanding of how that changed the game. Before 1905 or before 1906, the game was not filled with forward passes, but the forward pass was common. It was just illegal. And the reason I say that is because what we now think of as laterals, a term that entered football about 1914, or pitches, well, we think of laterals and pitches, they call passes, right? So if the quarterback got the snap from the center and he tossed it to a halfback or a fullback, that was a pass. And so a forward pass was just those instances where they were running around the field and they pitched it and inadvertently or deliberately tossed it forward. And so it was a penalty, and they'd call the penalty, and they, you know, lose possession of the ball and that kind of thing. And if you look at old newspaper reports, it's all over the place. Forward passes, almost every game, somebody's being penalized for a forward pass. So the game had a forward pass. It was illegal. And so when they were thinking about the new forward pass in 1906, they were pretty much thinking of that. They were thinking of forward laterals. So they weren't viewing it as this thing that was going to revolutionize the game. It was, and a number of committee members thought, yeah, we need it for a couple of years and we can get rid of it. So there was no notion of what was going to come down the road and how it would dramatically change the game. It was more of a, well, yeah, you can pitch the ball forward and, you know, whatever. So it wasn't what we think of it today.
They weren't thinking of Aaron Rodgers dropping back and, you know, dropping a 45-yard pass on a dime to a receiver streaking down the field then.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, that's right. And so, you know, some of it is even – there's some great illustrations of the period that show and discussions of what's the most effective way to throw the forward pass, right? And so really, I mean, in 1906, there was only one team I'm aware of who threw the ball in the overhand spiral motion that we think of as the forward pass today. everybody else was trying to figure out, like, okay, well, I'm only going to toss it a couple yards or, you know, whatever. And so they were, you know, some thought the best way to throw it was like tossing it like a grenade with a stiff arm, some, you know, basketball set shot. You know, there were a variety of different techniques like that. But, you know, it was all, you know, within a 10-yard, you know, kind of radius, maybe flipping it 15 yards downfield to somebody. You know, it not at all. And just conceptually, nobody had. The skies did not open up, and a stone tablet did not come down, giving the football world a passing tree, right? I mean, nobody had any idea what any of that would have looked like. You know, that was, you know, Sid Gilman and you know, 40, 50 yards in the future before that happened.
Okay, 1906, you said the forward pass came in with some restrictions on it. Maybe you could describe what some of those restrictions were.
When the forward pass first came in, at that point, that was during the era of the checkerboard field. And so probably a fair number of your listeners have seen a checkerboard field at one point or another. But so beyond the normal stripes every 5 yards, there were lines running perpendicular to those that were also 5 yards. So the reason those were there is in 1903, they instituted a rule that said that the first person to receive the ball from the center could not run forward or could not cross the line of scrimmage with the ball unless they were 5 yards right or left of the center. And this was to try to eliminate some fakery that was going on, you know, in the center area and to keep them from running up the gut all the time. But so when the forward pass was adopted, they basically followed that same rule and said, in order to throw a forward pass, the passer has to be 5 yards right or left of the center before they can throw the ball. There were other restrictions, and some of these, you know, changed a little bit over time, but there were restrictions. Prior to 1912, it was a more restricted game. So, you know, they had things like you couldn't throw the ball more than 20 yards downfield. You couldn't, if the ball crossed the goal line in a on the fly or on a bounce, it was a turnover. If you threw a pass and it was not touched by an offensive or defensive player before it touched the ground, it was a turnover. So, you know, if you think about the implications of that, you've got guys who don't really know how to throw a forward pass very well, trying to throw it to people who don't know how to run passing routes. And if they throw it too far, it's a turnover. If they miss, if they have an incompletion, it's a turnover. So it's really not surprising that for the first half dozen or so years of football, the forward pass didn't get used very much other than by a couple of select teams. And some of those did it very well.
And they were playing with a watermelon ball too, I imagine, right? Going more of a rugby. Okay.
Yeah.
I guess that would make it very difficult to try to figure out how to throw that ball, wouldn't it? It'd be tough for us today, I think, to try to figure out how to throw that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it really was one of the things early on, the ball was so thick that they basically kind of felt like unless the passer had big hands, they couldn't be an effective passer just because they couldn't get a grip on the ball, you know, and the lacing, you know, the laces were just, you know, relatively thin pieces of leather that laced the ball together. They weren't like, you know, we got polyvinyl chloride laces now that are stiff as a, you know, stiff as brick. So it's very easy to get, you know, spin on the ball and those kinds of things. That wasn't the case back then.
Reminds me of, we had a gentleman that one of my PFRA friends, Simon Herrera, he has a vintage football game. They replicate the games played in the early 1920s in the pro game. And he wanted to try to get it so they wouldn't throw passes. So he had a ball developed for these games that he has every year that's even a wider girth than the balls that you're talking about in the you know, 1906. So they can't pass the ball. I forget what it was, like 24 inch girth or something. It's ridiculous, like a medicine ball. So, and it was effective. They can't throw a pass with it. So but it sounds like this is a similar situation here for these folks that were trying to throw.
And the flip side of it is that, you know, as long as you had that rounded ball, that you could still continue to drop kick. But once you got to the, and you know, there were successive changes in the dimensions of the ball, once the ball got too pointy, drop kicking went away because you couldn't predict where the ball was going to bounce anymore.
Unless you're like, Doug Flutie, right?
Well, and he's playing on AstroTurf, not on some muddy field right. that guys played on back in the day.
Right. So who did throw the first pass successfully, and how did that come about? Because it seems like everything's against them wanting to throw a pass.
Well, so, you know, one of the things, an interesting thing that happened as the committee was kind of, as people are tossing out ideas on the changes that should occur in 1906, there were two teams out in Kansas that decided to play a game, a test game, to experiment and institute some of the potential rule changes. So Fairmont, which now is Wichita State, and Washburn played one another. And the coach of Washburn was a guy named John Outland, who the Outland Trophy is named after. And so they played a test game Christmas Day, 1905. You know, it's unclear exactly, you know, so they threw forward passes, but it's unclear what that means. You know, it's hard to believe that they would have really restructured their offense in any significant way. It probably meant that they just tossed the ball forward on a couple of occasions. I think only one forward pass was completed, and the game ended up like in a 0-0 tie or 6-6 tie, you know, whatever it was. So not a very good test of the process, but it points out the fact that it you have to really have time to let things sink in and conceptualize the changes that are about to occur. And so it then happened that in 1906, St. Louis U had a coach, last name, it was Eddie Cochins. He had played at Wisconsin and I think was an All-American or, you know, whatever. He was a star there. But he ended up with a guy who transferred from Wisconsin down at St. Louis U named Bradbury Robinson, who was a big, pretty big guy who had big hands. And he had learned to throw the overhand spiral. I guess he'd learned it by throwing the ball back when he was retrieving punts. But so he all said, you know, here's this guy who has this capability that nobody else had. And so St. Louis U basically, and Cochins, you know, built this offense around, you know, it's not like they just went to a passing offense, but, you know, they threw the ball far more than anybody else. They were undefeated in 1906. And before the season, I grew up in Wisconsin, but I used to live in St. Louis. So I know the weather in both places. And St. Louis is ungodly in the summer in terms of heat and humidity. So he took his boys up to Wisconsin for training camp back in the days when training camp meant you really did camp. And then as they were getting ready to go back to St. Louis, they played a local school then named Carroll College, which is my alma mater. now it's Carroll University, but they played a game and Bradbury Robinson threw the first forward pass in a legal, you know, authorized game. So I always claim that Carroll invented pass defense, which is true, I guess.
Yeah, I guess it would be.
Yeah, although St. Louis U won, so but so that game was played early September 1906, and you know, various teams tried the forward pass. Carlisle was, you know, an early innovator in its use. They always liked anything kind of tricky, but otherwise, it really did not get used much over the next couple of years, just because it was heavily restricted. And frankly, you know, the Eastern teams didn't really like it that much to begin with. Where it really saw some use was out West, and probably the, you know, one of the seminal moments in the forward pass didn't come until 1913 when, you know, Newt Rockne and Gus Dorius at Notre Dame visited Army for a game, and they were throwing the ball all over the place, and the New York sports writers and certainly the West Point football team were surprised at what they could do. And Notre Dame beat Army's butt. And, you know, it brought a lot of attention to what you could do with the forward pass if you think about it differently than most teams had thought about it to that point.
Now, it was sort of a slow progression, though, from 1906 to let's say 1912 to get the passing game to be that way for Rockne and the rest of Notre Dame to be throw the ball like that. Can you describe it? I think in 1912 you describe as being another pivotal year for the forward pass.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, it's like, so there's kind of three things going on. One is, like I said, you know, that so when they first approved the forward pass, there's just an inability to conceptualize what it could be. I mean, nobody thought it would be what Don Coryell or, you know, somebody else would produce, you know, down the road. There was also just an inability to figure out the techniques to use, which we've talked about a little bit. And then there were restrictions. So, you know, we had things like, you had to be 5 yards right or left. And, you know, this will play out again, but in a different form, like in the 40s. But, you know, what we think of as, you know, any kind of quick passing, you know, so a quick slant, right? I mean, not like they couldn't even think of a quick slant at the time, but because the passer had to be 5 yards right or left, he could never have thrown a quick slant. He could never have thrown a bubble screen. He could, there's things that we take for granted as part of football today and the passing game. Just, they couldn't even think about that as an opportunity because it wasn't legal, you know? So, you know, you basically were forcing the pass to occur on rollouts only.
Okay. So 1912 sort of eliminated that rule so that they could throw more of a traditional setting that we know passing as.
Yeah. By 1912, they dropped that 20 yards downfield rule. I believe they also dropped the rule that, I believe by then you could throw the ball into the end zone. So until 1912, there was no end zone, right? So there was this undefined area behind the goal line, but because it was illegal to throw the ball over the goal line, they didn't need an end zone per se. It had to be carried over the goal line. And so, 1912, they changed that. It was just one of those things where there's just all these incredible little tiny steps to make the game more open. But 1912 was a big one. So you can throw the ball as far downfield as you want. You can throw it into the end zone. You know, they later had restrictions where you could only throw one forward pass in a set of downs and things like that. But, you know, I think things opened up enough in 1912 that people could see how the forward pass could change the game. They still didn't use that much, you know, but it was getting there.
But, well, I guess in a way, I know you described this in the book, the passing restrictions being lifted, and especially that having those end zones defined as being 10 yards, it ended up changing the field from what the Canadians, you know, have the 110 yard field goal line to goal line still to this day. But our stadiums in the East, like you described, I know Harvard and Yale and a couple others had the cement stadiums where they were restricted with that only so much room to put a stadium in. They had to change to the 100 yard field with the two end zones. Is that correct?
Yeah. I edited a little bit just to say that the Harvard is an example of Harvard built what is still their stadium in 1903, and it was the first or the largest reinforced concrete building in the world at the time, blah, blah, blah. But the point was, it was there and it was going to stay there, right? And they had built that stadium so that it could accommodate a regulation football field and a fairly small track and some sideline area. Well, one of the discussions they had in 1905 was, should we widen the field like the Canadians had to open up the game? And, you know, with Harvard being one of the dominant forces in the game at the time, they were like, no, we're not changing our stadium, so we need to keep it as is. So they didn't widen the field in 1905. When it came to 1912, there you ran into an issue of the length of the field, not its width. And so there were stadiums like the Polo Grounds in New York City, where a lot of college games, you know, back then, a lot of college games were played in baseball parks because that's where the stadiums were, right?
Right.
And so depending on the configuration of the ballpark, you might not be able to fit the 110-yard field with 10-yard end zones on the end of it, so 130-yard field. You might only be able to fit 120-yard field. So what they ended up doing is they eliminated the 55-yard line. And, before, kickoffs had been from the midline instead of the 40, and they switched it to the 40 and things like that. So, fairly innocuous kind of change, but, that's one of the, Americans changed to the 50-yard line. It wasn't the Canadians who bastardized our game. We bastardized the game that we had kind of collectively agreed on.
and the same thing with three downs. That's sort of the way that Walter Camp designed it, was with three downs. And we changed that also down here. So
yeah. And that occurred in 1912 as well. So we switched to four downs.
Okay.
To gain 10 yards at that point.
So actually probably 1912 is almost as impactful as 1906 and maybe not as much as like the early 1880s, but truly some big changes there. And I can see why you have that incorporated as sort of your next era, the second phase of football, because there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, tremendous changes. And then from then on, there's more tweaking, some of which, some tweaks are bigger than others, but the 1906 to 1912 was a period of turmoil, but the game came out of it and started moving forward. Combination of thinking about the game differently, new techniques, and then rule changes loosened up the passing game.
Now, Tim, what do you think would have happened, now that we know the whole story arc of the passing game and all the changes that came because of between 1906 and 1912, in your opinion, would the game of football have survived without those revisions?
It's one of those where, okay, without revisions, I think the answer is no. I think there was enough push for the game to, enough recognition that the game was a dangerous game that without changes, I think it would have died. But I'm not sure that would have happened. I think just like today, I think football still has a lot of dangers in front of it in terms of CTE and all of that. But I think the game's going to change. It will address it. There are enough people who want the game to survive, and there's enough money behind, people who want the game to survive, that it'll adjust as it needs to. It may be slower than, some folks would like, but it will adjust. And so I think the same thing there. I think if the game, if it had not changed in 1906, okay, it probably would have been 1908 or 10 or something. But had it not changed, then I think it would have, what we saw with, as you mentioned, teams dropped football, or schools dropped football, Columbia dropped football, Northwestern dropped football, USC dropped football, Cal dropped football, Stanford dropped football, but those out in California, they switched immediately to rugby. And so one of the more interesting questions, I think, is had America switched from American or gridiron football to rugby, how would that have affected the game of rugby? How would the, would rugby be the same game it is today if America had been involved? Maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't, but I guarantee you, just based on the sheer population of the country and the, the big game, the California Stanford game, in the years they were playing rugby, that got all the attention that a football game had in the past. Big crowds, big press coverage, all of that.
Yeah, I believe even to this day, Australia is playing a like two or three different versions of rugby, just in that much smaller country than ours. So, yeah, I guess that would have had a big impact on rugby if United States would have been playing that. So, interesting.
And Canada had Canada kind of went off in its own direction. They played with what was called Canadian rugby, which had some elements of American football. It had downs and a scrimmage, but it was still much more of a wide open game, no blocking, at that time, whereas American football picked up blocking in the 1880s. And then they eventually merged back towards an American-like football, so Canadian football is now very close to American football, but Canadian rugby until the 20s or so probably was as similar to rugby as American football.
Okay. And then that's sort of where the Grey Cup came out. It was the Canadian rugby originally before the CFL. So very interesting. Now, I you talked earlier about you had the book on the military. Maybe you could tell us what the name of that book is. And I guess we're both your books and where folks could buy them at.
So one book is Fields of Friendly Strife. So it comes from the General MacArthur quote about the playing fields at West Point. But that's basically a book that follows the teams that played in the 1918 and 1919 Rose Bowls. So it was World War I. And so rather than having college teams play in the Rose Bowls, they had military teams play. So there's the Marine training camp on the West Coast, it's Mare Island. There was an Army training camp up near Tacoma called Camp Lewis. They played in the 1918 game. And then Mare Island met Great Lakes from near Chicago in the 1919 game. And that game included guys like, George Halas, who became a fairly famous name in football, but he was on the Great Lakes team, as were a number of others, some pretty top athletes. So basically the book kind of follows those teams as they're playing their season. The guys who had played in 1918, about half of them ended up shipping out and ended up in France, during World War I. And so it kind of traces them during all of that period and then their lives afterwards.
Wasn't that the game where Patty Driscoll threw the touchdown pass to Halas? Is that the game? Okay.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, great. Great. Okay. So that, and you have a website that's named after that original book. Maybe if you could tell us what that is. So listeners could go and check that out.
Yeah. So Fields of Friendly Strife, it started off really to support my first book. And then as I kind of turned the corner, a lot of my early information on there covers the, World War I and the teams and games. And then I pretty much go right into just various history of football topics. So I would say, the last 50 articles or posts that I have are pretty much straight football, but football history, mostly pre-1960. And, a lot of older stuff. I post articles, two, three articles a month. And so it's available at, fieldsoffriendlystrife.com. I've got a Twitter account, Facebook. So if you either search my name, Timothy P. Brown, or Fields of Friendly Strife, you'll come across it. It's, if you search Fields of Friendly Strife and you're looking for me, you're going to find it. So,
okay. Well, we'll also, listeners, we will have a link to Tim's site on our show notes of the podcast you're listening to, or you can go to pigskindispatch.com. We'll also have some backlinks there to get you there. So we'll make sure we'll get you the direction if you need that help. So, great site. I highly recommend the site. I highly recommend the book. Just a tremendous job that you did. And coming from an official to an old coach, that's hard to give compliments, I guess, going both ways. But I really enjoyed it. It's we're natural enemies, as my friend Joe Ziemba says.
It's a funny thing. I think for me, some of the stuff I enjoyed most of all in doing the research was the role of officiating. It's just the so you know, like things that the book covers, it covers, you know, when did referees start, what did referees wear along the way, right? Mm-hmm. What were their uniforms? When did penalty flags come into play? When did whistles or the horns that they use come into play? When did the gun come into play? You know, the referee signals to signal penalties. Well, that had a start too. So all of those kinds of things, you know, they weren't there when football started. They had to develop. And so, we just try to identify best as I could when those things started and who we can credit with those kinds of changes.
Yeah. Those evolutions still happen recently, you know, because I don't know if you probably remember, probably about 15 years ago, the NFL went from white knickers to wearing black pants, which in the officiating world was humongous. I had some arguments probably 25 years ago with some people I officiated with that were traditionalists. Said, no, white knickers are the traditional pants of officials. And I said, well, here, let me show you this photograph from, 1903. And, what's this guy wearing? He's wearing a black suit coat with, black pants, dark colored pants. Yeah. And, I hated the knickers because, especially before everybody had turf fields, you had grass stains, mud, and you know how wash and white is. It's tough, especially you do a Friday night game and you got to go do JV games the next day. And, you have only so many pairs of white knickers. So it's,
one of the things I've got it in the book, but one of my favorite aspects of officiating was, until the 20s, maybe the 30s, there was really no training for officials. You were just a former player who knew most of the rules. And so, and you had to be somebody who people trusted, kind of thought you were an honest citizen, right? But most football officials wore their letter sweaters when they were officiating. And if you look at box scores, really through World War II, the box scores of most games would list the officials and they'd tell you the school that they attended. And it was because, if you were an Ohio State guy, you did not officiate Ohio State games. You might do Michigan and Indiana and, Pitt or whatever. But so you're wearing your letter sweater of a different team was kind of a, number one, said, I know what I'm talking about because I want a football letter. But secondly, I'm impartial. I'm not rooting for the two teams that are on the field today.
Yeah, I know I've read some things where like Walter Camp, as he was coaching Yale, would go to New York City to officiate the Harvard Princeton game, for instance. Yep. I know I have a couple instances. So
there's some of the earlier Rose Bowls. USC was a lesser team back then, but they were their head coach. Was officiating the Rose Bowl. He was local, didn't have to pay a whole lot more than bus fare, And so,
it's just unbelievable. Besides the uniform changing, when I started officiating in the early 80s, later 80s, we, as a wing official, the head linesman and the line judge, they had you go probably within 2 yards of the widest offensive player. So if you had a wide out, you'd be 2 yards. Well, that changed probably in the 90s with the offenses changing, these kids getting faster. They said, okay, plant your butts on the sideline. Don't have to be close to officiate. So that was a big to do in the officiating world. And I can't even imagine, incorporating things like the forward pass and doing it with two or three officials on the field when you're so used to that, grinded out game in the middle. So,
I've got one of the articles on the website is about the history of down boxes. And chains, generally. And so, back in the day, what we now call the down box, back in the day, it really was a box. It was a stick with a box on it that had four sides and 1, 2, 3, 4, and they spun it around depending on what down it was. But the linesmen carried that around with them on the field, and they'd be, he'd be running down field with the sharp stick with a box on it. And so it's just that, certain things like that just seem crazy now. But it's just the way the game evolved, And so that kind of stuff, I just think that, it's fascinating to figure out, kind of how it happened and, why it changed, you know, from one period to another.
Well, it definitely is. And you do an excellent job of illustrating the changes and how it affected all aspects of the game. Like I said, you did a wonderful job and explaining the history of the forward pass today. And I really appreciate you coming on here and you know, sharing that with us. And we'd love to have you on again sometime if we can to talk about a different subject, because you're very interesting and you're very knowledgeable. So thank you.
You name the topic and I'll be there.
Okay.
It's fun. You know, fun to share information, because there's somebody else out there who's got some insight on something that neither of us have. And so let's learn from them too.
Absolutely. So preserve that football history. And we thank you for that. And that's what we're all about. And thanks for helping us do that tonight. So thank you very much.
Darren, my pleasure. Thank you.
At the Sports History Network, we're all about sports yesteryear, and so we're so pleased to introduce you to Row One, an online memorabilia gallery and shop that brings you sports history to life anywhere. The Row One gallery includes over 5,200 gorgeously reproduced prints of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, advertisements, and more in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, and more. And any gallery item may be printed in a variety of sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic, or poster paper. And in Row One shop, check out the thousands more of you unique items with a retro and historical designs dating back to 1876, including t-shirts, long sleeve shirts, phone cases, mugs, blankets, pillows, towels, and even shower curtains. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com, ROW number one, for access to the full Row One catalog and for gallery prints and gift items. Plus get a 15% discount off all prints on the Row One Pictorum Gallery with coupon code SHN15. Follow the link on the show notes. Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. PigskinDispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.